First Things Podcast. In this week's episode, we'll learn from one young couple what natural family planning gets right and sex ed doesn't get. We'll parse the Pew poll that shows mass attending Catholics defecting in this election cycle, not to Hillary, but from Trump. And we'll ask whether ordaining women as deacons would empower women in the Catholic Church or set them back. Our special guest in segments 1 and 2 is Leah Labresco. We may, incidentally, envision laundry as self-actualization, welcome my boss back from vacation, and recount an instance of fruitful dialogue with a Jesuit on Twitter. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. I'm joined by Leah Labresco. Leah is a graduate of Yale, a convert from atheism to Catholicism, and the author of Arriving at Amen, 7 Catholic Prayers That Even I Can Offer. She is a self-proclaimed science nerd. She is also not bad at math. She is a news writer for ESPN's 538, where she crunches numbers on politics, pop culture, and all the rest. She blogs on Catholic matters at Patheos, and is a frequent contributor to firstthings.com. Leah, good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Leah is also engaged to be married to First Things assistant editor Alexi Sargent, who also joins me on this segment. Welcome to both you crazy kids.
Aw, thanks, Julia.
Leah, last week you wrote for firstthings.com an essay titled What They Didn't Tell Me in Sex Ed. It grew out of your recent study of natural family planning and preparation for marriage. And if I read you right, you've been surprised at how accurate your NFP course has been about physiological matters compared to the sex ed that you received in health class at school. So can you explain that? First of all, for our listeners who may not know, what is natural family planning or NFP? And then what has surprised you about it?
Sure. So natural family planning is kind of a family of methods that people can use to track their fertility, either to try and conceive children, you know, to identify any problems that may be inhibiting that for the couple, or to delay pregnancy for a couple that has kind of, you know, some kind of larger struggle going on that means that having children right now is kind of an imprudent idea. And it's kind of, I say, a family of methods because there are several different kinds of ways of doing fertility tracking that use different indicators about a woman's body and her cycle. And people can kind of pick and choose the one that works best for them. Now, it's not the rhythm method, which is what people think of usually when they hear fertility tracking, which is the, let's imagine that everyone has some ideal cycle and then figure out when you'd be fertile if you were a different person, the median person, who will definitely not get pregnant or get pregnant if that's your goal. Like, but for you, not so much. You know, NFP is actually tailored to the individual, and that's what was so striking about it. Because what I felt was that in my sex ed classes, when it was, you're becoming a woman, you know, and all that weird animated whatnot in the class, you know, it's actually much more like the classes, you're becoming the median woman. And a lot of the discussion of what women were and how our bodies worked was really rounded down in terms of details. So there were a lot of things that felt like they were problems about my body that actually are well within the range of normal human anything.
Yeah, and one of the ironies that sort of lightly indicated by your piece for me is the following. The cliche, right, is that those who oppose physical and chemical methods of contraception are the benighted ones, and they're the ones who want and need women to remain in ignorance about their reproductive organs. Whereas those who are pro-contraception are also pro-education and pro-information. But what you've found is there's actually a pretty high level of ignorance and misinformation that's priced into these ostensibly really informative sex ed curricula, and that seems to go all the way up to the level of even some practicing OBGYNs who frequently will miscalculate the dates of conception of children because they dogmatically assume that all women's cycles are the ideal or median cycle, which is, what, 28 days long. And this seems demonstrably and obviously untrue. It seems really basic and also really uncomplicated, just rejigger your calendar. So by contrast, and indeed on its own terms, NFP is incredibly empirical and also fairly high tech, I think. But I guess my question to you as a science nerd is, can you explain this, what seems to me a very strange residue of ignorance about reproductive physiology among people who certainly are not bashful about such matters? Where does that come from?
Well, I think it comes from kind of a range of places. One is the commercial aspect, that a lot of things that people do to kind of deal with the fact of their fertility are options that are offered to them, you know, by the contraceptive industry or anyone else, where, you know, they're marketing something that will work for every person. And the way the pill works is by making every woman have the exact same cycle, the cycle of a person who appears to be pregnant and, like, briefly has a period and then appears to be pregnant again in terms of what the hormonal balance is. So it's much easier to kind of create a false thing that everyone can achieve, you know, chemically, than it is to market something that is a little more focused on the individual and requires work from the person to track it. Right. I think that's one pressure. I think the other thing is just that women are often neglected by the medical establishment again and again. You know, you can look at the social science that women who present with the same symptoms of pain or claims about pain as men are given lower doses of pain medication. Mm. They're told that they're just like having a lot of feelings and maybe they should try having fewer of them rather than, you know, be given pain medication appropriate to the surgery they've had. And then you kind of see that also in the way that women's bodies are treated when it comes to fertility. That the focus of most sex ed classes, especially when it starts about learning about your cycle, is unfortunately you're going to like be a little messy and bloody like once a month. Let's go over what you can do to like not have any problems with that. Mm-hmm. And the part of the cycle that's covered is the part that is like, you know, bad for the outside world rather right. than an explanation right. for the woman herself of what her body is doing and why she might care.
Right. Alexi, what about your NFP journey? What what can men learn from NFP? Please don't be graphic.
Thanks, Julia. You know, I think it is really valuable for men to study this too, you know, especially if they're planning on being married and being kind of partners in the, you know, practice of fertility and how we can interact with that. One thing I hear a lot from folks who kind of are looking at the Catholic attitude towards sex and contraception from the outside is, what exactly distinguishes natural family planning from the methods of artificial contraception that are condemned by the church, right? Isn't it just using the technology of a schedule rather than the technology of barrier methods of one sort or another? And I think that the real philosophical difference there that's becoming more and more clear as we look into natural family planning is that NFP requires you to treat the body and understand the body a certain way, right? As a thing with its own reality and dignity that you have to live with and interact with, you know, joyfully, sometimes in ways that are burdensome, but always in ways that kind of treat it with the respect of something that has a real meaning that's present there and is not simply raw material to be reshaped by the devices that we create.
Right. Leah, you had written and then we published your essay during NFP Appreciation Week. A couple days later, we published another essay titled NFP is Not Always Marriage Building by a young woman named Audrey Paulnow. Audrey argues that NFP is sometimes oversold to couples. Its advocates sometimes imply that it's a method that has no downsides, that it's easy, it makes your life easy, it brings you hotter sex and a stronger relationship. And this school of NFP advocacy is what brings us books with titles like Holy Sex! Exclamation point, a Catholic guide to toe-curling, mind-blowing, infallible loving. So this kind of rhetoric surely arises because NFP has to contend with that cliche that Catholicism rejects contraception because it hates sex in the body. And so the rejoinder is, well, no, in fact, we reject contraception because we love and dignify sex in the body. But then Audrey tries to point out in her piece that balanced against that, you know, very bullish rhetoric about NFP is the fact that NFP is in fact a discipline. It is challenging, and its challenges sometimes have psychological and interpersonal effects that may not be optimal. It may make rough patches in marriages rougher, at least in the near term. And so insofar as that truth is downplayed by advocates of NFP, insofar as NFP is pitched sometimes to couples as a prosperity gospel, it's going to fail them sooner or later, and they will chuck it. So I wonder what the two of you think about that, since you're currently, you know, targets of, you know, these pitches for NFP. This is a rhetorical problem, right? I mean, we want to put the friendliest, even the sexiest face on NFP, but it is a discipline and we have to be honest about that. So what do you think is maybe the optimally honest and effective way of marketing NFP to young couples?
Well, I think one thing is just to make it clear that NFP isn't that different from marriage also. Like, mm-hmm. marriage is also not all sunshine and puppies and exclamation points. That what marriage is it's a path towards salvation, which is going to include the cross and transfiguration of the cross. And, you know, also wonderful moments, to be clear. It's not all like a penitential discipline. But, you know, the real problem is that if you're not using that language about marriage to begin with, and that's really not just a thing about how our culture talks about sex, it is how people talk about marriage, that it's to make you happy, that it's like
it's
a big party,
it's
self-actualization or whatever. And that if you don't start with the right rhetoric about marriage, you're going to have trouble integrating talk about NFP or sex into this already, like, you know, half-dimensional, like, portrait of what marriage is. It's not surprising NFP has hard bits or bits that make life harder for the couple, because marriage will have that too. It would be weird if NFP were entirely positive, just as it would be weird if any other dimension of marriage, like laundry, which is like less exciting, like no one would market laundry as like, it will be solely rapturous. Every week you'll come together in this moment of cleanliness.
Well, like, though, if you were creating commercials for a laundry detergent, you would in fact... Right. And so that's kind of the position that advocates of NFP, I think, often are in. You know, they have a tough sell. How do we make this seem fun? But I think you're right. Just a greater realism about not just what, you know, the burdens and joys of sex are like, but also the burdens and joys of marriage. Thank you both. Leah, will you stick around to talk a little Trump in the next segment?
Oy, gewalt. I guess since you've locked the doors, I will.
Thanks for having us, Julia.
I'm joined again by Leah Libresco, who, as I speak, is putting on her poll analyst hat. We're going to talk some Trump. I'm also joined by First Things editor Rusty Reno. Rusty, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Leah, last week you wrote a piece for 538 titled, Trump is Driving Catholic Voters Toward Clinton. In it, you report on a Pew poll that shows, among other things, that Catholic Republicans are defecting to Clinton in this election cycle, whereas evangelical Republicans are staying put. Could you walk us through some of the points of interest in that poll and maybe say what you make of it overall?
Yep, so Pew is taking a look at comparing what's going on now to what happened 4 years ago. They're looking at how Catholic and evangelicals were leaning with regard to the election of registered voters. You know, and Catholics, both Catholics who attend Mass weekly and Catholics who attend Mass less than weekly, were, in the case of less than weekly attenders, kind of weekly favoring the Democrat this time 4 years ago. And the ones who attend Mass weekly favoring the Republicans. This year, whoop, it's a 22-point swing for weekly Mass-going Catholics towards the Democratic nominee. And I think what's most interesting isn't just the fact of the swing, but the reason for the swing. So what I looked at in a little more detail is, for both Catholics and evangelicals who are supporting the Democratic nominee, how do they characterize the reason for that choice? Do they say that they're supporting Clinton or they're stopping Trump? And when you compare, for Catholics, the pattern versus 4 years ago for weekly Mass attending Catholics, there are a lot more people planning to vote for the Democrat and a lot fewer who are voting for Clinton for her own sake than there were for Obama for his. So much of that gain has all been made up of people who oppose Trump. And even for evangelicals, it's about the same number of people who are weekly church attending evangelicals who support the Democratic nominee. But it's gone from being kind of 2-1, 3-1 supporting Obama versus opposing Romney to about the opposite proportions. Almost every evangelical who's going to vote for the Democrat is voting against Trump.
Right.
Only a small number are voting for Clinton.
Is the evangelical Democratic vote holding steady at about a quarter?
Well, for people who are evangelicals, what there has been is there's been actually a big increase in support for the Republican nominee relative to last cycle among people who attend church less. So weekly church-going evangelicals have stayed kind of flat in support for the Republicans compared to last year, yes. last cycle. But the people who are actually less connected to their church are even more heavily supporting Trump than they were
Romney. And
then
when we look at the Catholic, the irregular church-going Catholic, are they also more Trump-friendly than the regular church-going
Catholic?
No,
they've swung harder towards the Democrats. Both groups of Catholics are swinging harder
towards
the Democrats.
But what's interesting to me is it seems that weekly mass attending Catholics are swinging even harder Democratic than are less observant.
Yeah,
Catholics.
I think the reason there is pretty straightforward. Church going now correlates with education, so that a college educated person is more likely to go to church than a non-college educated person, and so it doesn't surprise me that the cohort that's the most pro-Trump are high school educated voters. Especially high school educated white voters.
And the other confounding factor is you have a lot more Hispanics who are regular churchgoers who are, again, less likely to support Trump
right.
in the first place.
Right. So I guess the evangelical one would be more of a kind of pure instance of that, where you have, I can understand why, you're kind of a pious evangelical churchgoer, regular, very devout, very engaged in your congregation. I mean, Trump is not a person who exemplifies Christian virtues at all. But on the other hand, the Obama administration has been very aggressive and kind of thrown a lot of punches at traditional religious conservatives. And I think Trump appeals to anybody who feels like they're getting beaten up in the current climate, whether it's economically or culturally. And maybe it's the case that evangelical Christians, Catholics, just are not as uncomfortable in the current cultural climate as traditional evangelicals are. When I travel around, that's kind of my experience. Catholics aren't necessarily happy about, they're pro-life, favor of traditional marriage, but they feel less under assault.
I think that is true, that there's less of that sense of loss that often turns up when people are interviewing Trump voters of something they had that's not there anymore that they want to get back, and whether Catholics have had lower expectations throughout or anything else.
Well, no, I think it has to do with the fact that for American Protestants think of America as a Christian nation, mm-hmm. and they feel like they've lost the country. That certainly was part of the rhetoric of the religious right in the 70s and 80s, whereas Catholics... it's a more international sensibility, perhaps, somewhat. And also, there's a long history of Catholics not being included in the American Project precisely because they were not Protestants. Being on the outside is sort of in the DNA of American Catholicism and maybe makes people less horrified, if you will, by the cultural changes that they nevertheless don't want.
Rusty, you are, if not pro-Trump, at least anti-anti-Trump.
Right.
And you are a Catholic Republican. Why are you sticking with the Donald while others of your profile are defecting? Under a prospective Trump administration, what do you foresee would be the role or position of religious conservatives? Would life get better for us or get worse for us?
Compared to a Clinton administration, it would clearly get better. Trump is...
What about compared to now?
Things may get worse, but not as worse.
Okay.
Just because of the trajectory of our culture. Mm-hmm. But Trump has shown himself largely disinterested in the kind of moral questions that I think are really important. But disinterest does not characterize the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party today is actually very interested in moral and cultural issues in a way that is antagonistic to what I care about. Moreover, religious conservatives have been put into a very bad position over the last 10 to 15 years. So we have to be in a frenzy all the time to go to the polls to vote against the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And that has created, I think, atmosphere of perpetual crisis, which is not healthy. And then on the other hand, certainly since 2012, Democrats have discovered that they can motivate their base into a sense of perpetual crisis by raising the specter of a theocratic takeover of American society by wicked, evil haters and bigots like me. And so this polarizing rhetoric, I think Trump's just not interested in these things. He's shifting the political debate to other issues having to do with globalization and America's role in the international scene that don't have to do with my issues. I feel like it gives me a little bit of breathing room. We can kind of rethink what our role in public life is, which I think we have to do. We can't continue with the strategies and positions that we've had for the last generation. We have to rethink what contribution conservative Christians can make to American public life. I don't say I give the answers to that, but I do think Trump gives some breathing room to rethink.
So vote Trump precisely because Trump doesn't care about us. But there's a real logic to this. It's paradoxical, but there's a real logic.
I think so. There is a advantage of the fact that whatever bad things that Trump represents, he does not represent the religious right.
Rusty, I'm kind of wondering how much you think Trump would take people off that crisis footing, especially this past week where he's kind of questioned the legitimacy of the debates, started laying the groundwork to question the legitimacy of any election he'll lose, where it seems like it amps up the sense that politics and political discourse is all a crock, that rigged language coming up again, and gives less space to navigate any of these questions going forward.
No, I think it refocuses our fraught, anxious, polarizing political debate around what it should be focused on, which is the growing divide between the top 10 to 20% of society and everybody else. And that's what we should be thinking about. And that is a crisis, to be quite frank, I think, in our society. One reason I'm anti-Trump is I really feel that our leadership class simply doesn't want to face that fact, that their interests and way of thinking has become fundamentally different from that of median voters. And so I don't like the way Trump uses a kind of crisis atmosphere in order to advance his interests. I don't like that at all. That's very perilous and very dangerous. But we're going to have to confront that problem one way or the other. And that's not, at the end of the day, a problem. It is a moral problem because it's a moral imperative that a society have a sense of common purpose and that we're in a, if you will, a kind of civic friendship, that we all trust each other to be essentially pushing for the same goals. And that's fraying in our society, that trust that everyone, in spite of our political disagreements, is really after the same good, which is the flourishing of our country and the flourishing of the citizens of our country.
It's a very unifying note on which to end. Thank you both. Thanks, Leah, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to see you again.
I'm joined now by First Things literary editor Matthew Schmitz. Matthew, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. The big news out of Rome this week is that Pope Francis has appointed a commission comprising 6 men and 6 women to study the issue of women deacons in the Catholic Church and make recommendations for the future. There's some question what exactly was the Pope's intention in setting up this commission. Not too long ago, when asked about it, he quipped, "When you want an issue not to get resolved, form a commission." Who knows what is in the mind of Francis? But Matthew, you wrote an article for the Catholic Herald this week. in which you argue that women were never less visible and influential in the church than they have been since Vatican II, and that ordaining them as deacons won't help matters. Can you unpack that?
Gladly. So the argument in my article is that whereas women once played a very large and visible role in the church, especially as religious sisters of different kinds, so there would have been more active and contemplative sisters inside and outside the cloister, but you know, most visibly and most obvious in worldly terms, we saw many sisters who were educating children, tending the sick, caring for the elderly, doing missions work, running hospitals, running schools, running religious houses. And during the conciliar period, there was an updating and leveling impulse, one of the things that many people believed at that time. We needed to have sisters, say, leave the abbey, go out into the world, be active in the world, maybe shed the habit and dress like everyday people. In the wake of the council, instead of women becoming far more active, religious women becoming far more active in the world, far more active in the church, we saw the convents empty. In 1965, at the close of the Second Vatican Council, there were 180,000 religious sisters, Catholic religious sisters in America. The most recent figures we have from 2015, there are only 48,000. We basically have one quarter of what we once did. And so I don't think this has been a good period for women in the church, and I begin my piece by just pointing out that they've never been less visible than they are today, and we've reached today because of what the reformers wrought.
Right, and you don't see ordaining women as deacons. You don't see that as a way of rectifying this. In fact, you see it as something that could possibly even set us back. So you had an interesting line in your piece where you said, the church has closed off the possibility of women ever being ordained priests, and so women deacons would at most be able to play second fiddle. The Catholic Mass would become a play of feminine subservience. What do you mean exactly by that?
Not everyone liked my claim that deacons play second fiddle. It's certainly nice to be able to talk about things in happy clappy terms where, really, if you look at things the right way and you squint, everyone has equal honor and all of that. Sure. But there's no doubt that the priest is the one who's really officiating and celebrating the Mass, and that the deacon is his assistant, much as I was an assistant when I was an apprentice electrician in high school and would follow around the journeymen and hand them the tools they needed, go run and fetch things and do some important things, but under their supervision. So we know, and Francis knows, women cannot become priests. At best, they can become assistants to priests. This is not the way to advance equality. And if we do get women deacons, we're going to hear people pointing out this fact, which I am pointing out now, and using it to call for making women priests as well.
So I take it you've never felt a call to the permanent diaconate.
No, I have not. Right, so you say permanent diaconate. Before the Second Vatican Council, it would have been the case that men would have been ordained deacons only in anticipation, at least in more recent church history, of their being made priests. The Second Vatican Council, they said, well, we'll have permanent deacons, men who are ordained to the diaconate, who will never become priests, and they'll be allowed to, if they're already married, they'll be able to remain in that marriage, of course. So that's where we get that term, permanent diaconate. Anyway, so how about you, Julia? Are you, you asked me if I'm looking to become a deacon. How about yourself? Am I closing a door that you'd like to walk through?
You're not. I'm far too worldly and selfish. I feel a strong call.
Let's suppose something that is not impossible, which is that you progress in holiness. Would you then have any interest?
I feel a strong call to fame and fortune, less so to self-abnegation. But no, I wouldn't. My more public point about the permanent diaconate is that I've never been hugely impressed by it or inspired by it. I'm sure it has many practical uses, but on the whole, I think it's a bit of a missed opportunity and something of and embarrassment. I think we'd do better to abolish it than to extend it to women.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I know men who are deacons, I have great respect for them. I don't think it's strictly necessary that we have it, but you know, I've certainly benefited from the ministry of many deacons.
What's your sense of the theology of this question? Can women deacons be made consistent with the ancient teaching of the church?
So we know, and it's beyond dispute, that there have been women active in the life of the church who are called deacons. It's not my desire to speak against them or their work, but there's a tendency among reformers in Catholic life today to kind of do a kind of self-serving form of ressourcement. They return to the sources of the faith, but you know, it's often very unclear what the thing how the thing they're returning to actually was understood, and so they revive it in a way that doesn't make the church seem more like its ancient self, but instead conforms it to the banalities of the age. So, you know, we had with the liturgical reform at the time of the Second Vatican Council, people saying, well, we need versus populum. Priests should celebrate the Mass facing the people, because that's how it was done in the early church. Well, it turns out that wasn't how it was done in the early church. There was bad scholarship at play, but what was motivating the desire to call on that bad scholarship was an updating impulse, not a properly archaeological or traditional one. So I think that's happening today. And when we say, oh, well, there were women deacons in the early church, there's very little interest in understanding what that looked like. And instead, they simply want to make women be deacons, you know, permanent deacons, in the sense that that position was created at the time of the Second Vatican Council.
Right. There's a kind of popular argument that is floating around online, which even I think some conservative commentators have found congenial. And I don't want to get into the weeds on this because I find it tedious and I think it's a red herring, but it seems to come down to an emanation from a penumbra in a motu proprio from 2009. And the argument is that in this document, Pope Benedict changed the ontology of the diaconate, made it so that, or clarified that deacons do not act in persona Christi. And so if that's the case, then, you know, need we bar women? As I say, I think that this is a very sort of hair splitting and misguided argument. But even if the argument about that motu proprio were stronger, you know, I'm no expert in these matters, certainly, but I can read the Catechism. Article 1554, Catholic doctrine teaches that the degrees of priestly participation, episcopate and presbyterate, and the degree of service, diaconate, are all three conferred by a sacramental act called ordination, that is, by the sacrament of holy orders. Article 1577, only a baptized man validly receives ordination. Article 1538, the word ordination is reserved for the sacramental act, which integrates a man into the order of bishops, presbyters, or deacons. There's nothing to talk about here, it seems to me. I mean, we can sort of argue about the history of women deacons and what that meant in its time and what is proper ressourcement. But it seems to me that the Catechism speaks very definitively on this. This is sort of the authoritative teaching tradition pertaining to this issue. And it's not my feminine genius that tells me this. It's the same part of my brain that tells me 2 + 2 = 4. Insofar as I, as a Catholic woman, have any particular thoughts about this, I actually find it all rather insulting. It's the notion that we have to pretend black is white, or some women will get upset. Dry your tears, ladies.
This logic of mincing concern for women only works one way. You have commentators like James Martin, S.J., saying on Twitter, look, after Jesus was challenged by a woman, he changed his mind. A woman on Twitter pointed out that this statement was dubiously orthodox. A woman, in short, a woman challenged James Martin. And after this, did he change his mind? As he said, Jesus, on whom he presumably models himself, did? No, He just told the woman to read his tweets and brush up on his brilliant thoughts. So it, listening to women is all fine unless they tell us that we can't have the more modern, progressive, and Jetson age church, which increasingly looks old fashioned. If we can't have our Jetson age church, then we won't listen to women.
It is always good to encounter Father James Martin, SJ, in dialogue. We should have him on sometime.
I'd like that very much.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks again to our guest, Leah Labresco, and to her intended, Alexi Sargent. Thanks to Rusty and Matthew, and thank you listeners for listening. We'll do it again next week.